Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. All right. Okay. So today, like I said, we're talking about an event, a massive event that happened in the autumn of 1537. It was related to the birth of Edward, Prince Edward, but it was not the birth of Prince Edward. It was the death of Jane Seymour, his mother, and her funeral. Let's get into it. In the autumn of 1537, the halls of Hampton Court Palace echoed with the triumphant news that had been long awaited in England. Queen Jane Seymour had given birth to a healthy male heir, the future King Edward VI. It was a moment of unparalleled joy for Henry VIII, fulfilling his fervent desire for a legitimate male successor. However, the joy was ephemeral, overshadowed by the impending tragedy. As the days passed, it became clear that Jane, after her very difficult labor, was not recovering as expected. Though I have to say, there are a lot of theories about this. So people say she died of childbed fever. The thing that's very interesting was that she had seemed to recover. She was actually up writing letters announcing the birth. It wasn't like sometimes in movies they show it was like this really hard labor and then she just never recovered. She was actually up and she was, receiving visitors, writing letters, all of that. And then she took a turn for the worse. And so Alison Weir has a very interesting theory in one of her recent books on Jane Seymour, where she talked about a theory that she has after talking with doctors and reading all of the different chronicles and stuff. So I will link to that there, I think, and you can check that out. How's that for a tease, right? I can't tell you the whole thing because then you wouldn't watch the video, and I want you to watch the video. So, got to do these things. Okay. So she, of course, transformed from a radiant mother to a fragile figure confined to her bedchamber. And October 24th, just 12 days after her son's birth, Jane's condition worsened irrevocably, leading to her untimely death. Complications from childbirth, some other thoughts, who knows? There's a lot of theories, like I said. Henry VIII's reaction was profound. The king, who had celebrated the birth of his son with grandeur, was now thrown into an abyss of grief. Retreating from courtly affairs, he secluded himself in Windsor, grappling with the loss of the wife who had given him his long-desired heir. He was lost in his sorrow, so he handed over the funeral arrangements to his trusted courtiers, the Duke of Norfolk and Sir William Paulet. Their task was not only to ensure a befitting farewell for a queen, but also to gather a cortege for the transfer of the queen's body from Hampton Court to Windsor. Norfolk and Paulet delved into the archives. They looked back at the most recent funeral for a queen, which would have been Henry's mother, Elizabeth of York. And their findings detailed the nobility that had attended Elizabeth's funeral
Earls, barons, knights, determined to give Jane an even grander send-off, Norfolk summoned an even larger assembly of the English nobility. Among those who were called were influential figures like, of course, the Duke of Suffolk, the Marquis of Dorset and Exeter, and many prominent earls. In a pious gesture, Norfolk commissioned 1,200 masses to be sung, honoring the departed queen's soul. Let's think for a second. This is October 1537, right? And look, I'm no fan of Henry VIII. I'm not going to try and excuse his barbarism, but let's just think for a minute of what this period would have been for him. Like we talk about, sometimes we go through periods where like just nothing's going right. So in less than 2 years, he has this terrible jousting accident. Anne has a miscarriage. Then he's convinced in some way, he manages to convince himself that Anne has cheated on him and perhaps even put a spell on him. And she's executed. And of course, he probably found ways to, you know, make himself the victim in that in his own mind. So then Anne's put to death. Then his son, Henry Fitzroy, dies. He's married to Jane, just married to Jane at the time. There's some theories that Jane had a miscarriage early on, too. Again, not sure, but that might have happened because she then got pregnant with Edward by January, February. So then, you know, the beginning of 1537 is good. But then, you know, he has this baby. It's all good. And then his wife dies. I mean, it's like 15, 16 months of just like one thing after another, I would assume, from his perspective. So he was really in a bad place. So on October 25th, in a solemn ritual, Jane Seymour's entrails were buried in the Chapel Royal at Hampton Court. The embalmed body, adorned with a golden robe, jewels, and a crown, lay in state in the presence chamber. Surrounded by tapers, an altar nearby echoed with the chants of masses that were sung day and night for her soul. A significant ceremony involved the body's transfer to the Chapel Royal, and then the queen lay in state under the vigil of her ladies, prominent household servants, and Lady Mary, Princess Mary, the king's eldest daughter, who was the chief mourner. Mary was showing her respect. She even financed masses to be sung in Jane's name and managed the queen's household during this period of mourning. The stage was set, and soon the journey to her final resting place would begin. On November 8th, a grand procession departed from Hampton Court, marking the commencement of Jane Seymour's final journey to Windsor. Her body was placed on a horse-drawn hearse, preceded by 200 torch-bearing men, each wearing the Queen's badge. The chief mourner, Lady Mary, trailed behind the hearse, donned in somber black velvet, and she led 29 mourners, each symbolized a year of Jane's life. There was a wax or wooden effigy of the queen also paraded around, a testament to, you know, the fact that she was royal. As the procession snaked through its route, people lined the streets with candles. They were kind of living beacons for this nationwide mourning that was going on. And their silence was intermittently broken by clergy or local leaders who welcomed the cortege at various junctures. On arriving at St. George's Chapel in Windsor on November 10th, the resonant toll of bells accompanied the sight of the dean and college emerging to greet the procession. The queen's body, gracefully carried by 6 pallbearers, was met at the high altar by Archbishop Cranmer. Amid prayers, Jane lay in state, a hallowed sight, with Lady Mary maintaining a devoted vigil. By the next day, the chapel echoed with chants of the Requiem masses and dirges, and the coffin, embellished by velvet palls from the Queen's ladies, cradled the effigy of Jane. When November 12th dawned, the final ceremony unfolded. With a sea of faces, including her brothers Edward and Thomas, in attendance, the Queen was accorded full honors. The deep silence was broken only by the ceremonial shattering of the Queen's officers' staves, signifying the conclusion of their allegiance. The closing rites for the Queen began on November 14th at St. Paul's Cathedral. The Lord Mayor attended, and alms were graciously distributed to the poor, all in the name of the departed Queen. This heartfelt gesture marked the end of the official funeral for Jane, but the grief lingered. Of course, the court was draped in mourning through Christmas, It was only by February 3rd, 1538, that Henry, with a heavy heart, decreed the end of the mourning period. The once somber court saw the return of color as people resumed wearing their standard clothing, yet, of course, the depth of Henry's affection for Jane remained evident. 9 years on, he chose to lie beside her at Windsor, foregoing the familial resting place at Westminster Abbey, a testament to the space that Jane held in his heart. Today, we are going to talk about smallpox, because why not start out the week with a little chat about a deadly disease, right? It's Monday. Start the week out right. The reign of the Tudors was a time of sweeping change, reformation, political intrigue, and unfortunately, the spread of deadly disease. We did a video a couple weeks ago on the sweating sickness. Today, we're going to talk about smallpox. Smallpox was responsible for the deaths of countless people across Europe, and its scars, both literal and figurative, left deep marks in society. And of course, it continued all the way up until, you know, the 20th century. And the vaccination against smallpox was one of the first, the inoculation. I remember having read George Washington had ordered inoculations against smallpox to all of the soldiers in the Revolutionary War. So it wasn't just the Tudor period, but it was especially, you know, one of those things that the Tudors had to think about in addition to the sweating sickness. And it affected everybody, of course. One of the most famous cases in the 16th century was Elizabeth I. She caught smallpox in 1562. Of course, everybody was panicked because she did not have any children. There was no heir. It was very severe. For time, it was uncertain whether she would recover. And also some of the people who were taking care of her contracted smallpox. She was left with minimal scarring. Of course, others were not so lucky. The disease left the notorious pock marks on people's faces, on survivors, leaving them a lifetime reminder of their brush with death. There was also Mary, Queen of Scots. She had smallpox as a child, but she emerged relatively unscathed. She didn't have any lasting marks, which would have marred her famed beauty. Her escape from the physical remnants of the disease was actually really unusual, and some even saw that as a divine sign of her destiny for greatness. Edward VI also got smallpox. He wrote a letter in 1552 to a friend of his saying that he had had a bout with smallpox, a small bout with smallpox, but he was quite past it. He got measles right after smallpox, so it's like a 1-2 punch. And that, of course, weakened him considerably. He recovered from both, but they might have contributed to his early death that he had soon after. These royal cases, of course, are just the tip of the iceberg. Smallpox did not discriminate between royalty and commoner, rich or poor, and it spread across England, and the subsequent efforts to contain and combat it tell a fascinating story of a nation grappling with a silent, invisible enemy. During the medieval period, many devastating illnesses like the Black Death overshadowed the presence of smallpox. But by the time the Tudors came into power, smallpox began to manifest more noticeably. Historians and scientists speculate on the reasons for the uptick, but it could include the rise of urbanization and trade. The Tudors, of course, saw significant growth in urban population centers and international trade. More people living in close quarters in cities, increased movement between cities and countries. Infectious diseases found it easier to spread. Also, during the Tudor period, the distinction between smallpox and other diseases might have become clearer. It might have been that during the medieval period, smallpox was lumped in with other diseases, just under general diseases. So it might have actually been more difficult to trace the actual prevalence of smallpox. And then with the Protestant Reformation and other societal shifts, there was more detailed record keeping with the printing press, with, you know, people becoming more literate. A society based more on words and literacy, people start keeping better records. So that gives us a clearer picture of smallpox and the growth of smallpox, the experience of smallpox in the Tudor period than we had in previous periods. Also, the Tudor period, of course, was marked by religious upheavals, and that changed and influenced how people viewed the disease. Some people saw it as a divine retribution for, you know, breaking away from the Catholic Church, for example, while other people started looking for more earthly causes. We start to see the very, very nascent beginnings of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution that would happen, you know, 100 years later. But people are starting to look for more earthly reasons. I literally have goosebumps. I think about this period. The thing that really gets me about this period is this beginning of the what I find so, I literally have goosebumps, you guys. What I find so fascinating about the Renaissance is people singing for the sake of singing, right? It wasn't just for church. Church was a huge part of it, but people with the rise of secularism. And, you know, I'm actually, personal share, I didn't intend for this to go this way, but here we are. I'm actually fairly religious. I'm Episcopalian. I'm practicing. And I believe in God. I believe in, you know, the universe, and I'm very spiritual. So I have that. But also, I also think that humans are pretty amazing, and humanity is pretty amazing. I'm one of those people, I don't actually like a lot of individual humans, but humanity as a whole, I really get down with, and I really love. And, you know, looking at this rise of humans and seeing themselves as beings apart, this life as an important life apart from what's to come. Before, in the 1,000 years before, I mean, it wasn't so much, I don't know as much about like Rome and Greece. I've been reading more about that period and listening to some podcasts, but we start to see after 1,000 years of the church teaching that this life is just practice for the life to come, and people being not necessarily okay with being poor and being serfs and stuff. We start to, people still kind of, it was drilled into them that, you know, this life is just practice, and this is your role in life, and you're a serf, and that's all there is. And obviously people found joy and people found contentment in different ways. But during the Renaissance, we really started to see the beginnings of humanism, of people saying, look, we can live this life for now. We can live a beautiful life here. We can sing for the sake of singing. We can make art for the sake of making art. And that then leads to writing for the sake of writing and studying for the sake of studying. And that's the stuff that just, that beginning, I find so fascinating, that push-pull between religion and secularism and just the idea that, you know, people in the past had always seen disease as something from God. This is the period where we really start to see people saying, well, maybe there's germs. I mean, of course, germs would take another 300 years. 400 years almost for germs to become a thing. But yeah, this is the start. This is the very seeds being planted. And I just find that very moving. And it's like watching, we always say having a daughter, having a child, that period, it's like watching this flower bloom, watching this little thing come to life, right? And that's what this period is for me, is like that, just watching humanity kind of wake up. And I just, you guys, it gets me. It moves me. I need a drink. So that's not actually an alcoholic drink. It's just coffee. But anyway, what was I talking about? Smallpox. I really went sideways, you guys. Okay. Let's get back to smallpox. So yeah, we weren't quite at the scientific revolution yet, but we were so close. Just so close. You can start to see it. Oh, I love it. Okay. So the way smallpox presented itself: fever, fatigue, headaches, backaches. Within a few days, the distinct and dreaded rash would appear, first on the face and then spreading to the rest of the body. These reddish spots would then evolve into raised pustules, which upon rupturing left the characteristic scars that gave the disease its name. They were also called pox, which then is where you get smallpox. Transmission was mainly through direct contact, either from fluid from the blisters or particles expelled when an infected person coughed or sneezed. Given the close-knit structure of communities and households, it's really easy to see how smallpox would spread with alarming speed. Compounding the problem, of course, was the lack of understanding about the true nature of the contagion. People didn't know about viruses or how diseases spread, and the concept of quarantine was still in its infancy. The societal impact of smallpox in Tudor and Elizabethan England was profound. The fear of disfigurement was genuine, particularly in a society where physical appearance, especially women, could really affect one's marriage prospects and social standing, and was seen as, again, like whether God smiled on you or not. If people saw physical disfigurement, we talked about this in the video that I just did on whether or not Anne Boleyn had six fingers, right? People saw it if you had some kind of disfigurement as, you know, being God was angry with you, you had displeased God. And so that was something people were genuinely afraid of. And also, you know, it was very deadly. Queen Elizabeth's survival and minimal scarring were exceptions. Many who survived found themselves facing stigmatization due to their pockmarked faces. Beyond the frequent, and you know, it's so silly because you would think that people all understood, like, oh, you had smallpox and you lived. That's a sign of like divine providence. Yay for you. God smiled on you. But no, it was like, oh, look, you have a pockmarked face. God must be mad at you. Humans find the most interesting ways to twist things around, don't you think? Don't you think? Guys, I've really, like, I don't know what my issue is today. It's just, it's all coming out. It's all coming out. All right. Beyond the physical effects, the frequent outbreaks disrupted daily life. Trade could come to a halt. Court functions would be postponed. Public gatherings would be sparse during severe outbreaks. We kind of all know about this. This had implications on the economy, political, and social activities of the time. Don't we know it? We have just all lived through that. Moreover, the unpredictability of smallpox, which could claim the lives of both the robust and the frail, the rich, the poor, the young, the old, fostered a climate of uncertainty. It was a grim reminder of life's fragility, prompting introspection, sometimes fatalistic attitudes. Treatment during the Tudor and Elizabethan period was a mix of genuine attempts at medical intervention and superstition-infused remedies. The disease, with its ghastly presentation and devastating effects, drove physicians and lay people alike to seek relief or a cure through various means. Many remedies, grounded more in tradition than actual science, were popular. People applied herbs like rose or lily, while others were more bizarre, like tying a red cloth around the afflicted person or placing the patient's bed linens in rose bushes, hoping to transfer the disease to the roses. Of course, there was bloodletting, as always, to try to balance the humors. Of course, there was no inoculation yet. That wouldn't really start full on until the 18th century. The lasting impact, of course, was multifaceted. Physically, survivors had scars, which could alter their life trajectory. Elizabeth I's bout led to a temporary crisis as the line of succession was unsecured. And lastly, it began to sow the seeds of public health awareness. The recognition of the disease's contagious nature led to early quarantine measures. And in the longer term, these experiences would lay the groundwork for more systemic approaches to combating infectious diseases.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe, History and Coffee, Heather Tesco. You will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, ascend, for may be sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's ArmOdillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.